Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1035, interview number 5 with Jim DiGiugemio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on November 27th of 2018. And once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airways Jim DiGiugemio, the author of the triumphal Destiny Betrayed and other titles, and we'll tell you about the website and an online radio venue at which you can hear more from Jim. Jim, welcome back to our airways.
Nice to be here, Dave.
We have been talking about some of the foundational elements, both historical and some of the networking that underlies the JFK assassination. And ultimately, we will get into New Orleans, D.A. Jim Garrison's investigation of same. I would like to do a deep dive in our next couple of shows into Lee Harvey Oswald, the Marxist Marine. I think in terms of understanding that, why don't you explain in turn, Jim, particularly for the benefit of younger listeners, who James Jesus Angleton was, and also the false defector program to the former Soviet Union?
All right. James Angleton was the director of counterintelligence for the Central Intelligence Agency at the time of Kennedy's assassination. And in fact, he had been there for over 10 years prior to Kennedy's assassination. And because of his position and because of the monumental weight of the Cold War at this time, if you're the chief of counterintelligence, then at that time, the main target was the Soviet Union. You know, I don't have to explain that to your listeners. I think pretty easy to understand, all right? And so James Angleton was constantly on the watch for things like defectors from coming out of Russia, okay? And also the hope that he could send somebody into Russia, all right? It was very difficult for at this time for Angleton to get a what they call an agent in place. What that means is that you recruit an agent inside the Soviet Union. He now becomes a double agent. And instead of bringing him out, you leave him in there, okay? Angleton only had maybe two of these guys, all right? And the Russians found out about one of them, a guy named Pankovsky, all right? Now, so therefore, in order to get more intelligence on what's going on inside the USSR, preferably Moscow, all right, or one of the other major cities like Leningrad, all right, there began in the late 50s a program by the CIA to go ahead and send what we would call today false defectors into the USSR. Now, if anybody's ever seen the movie The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, all right, that famous picture with Richard Burton and Claire Bloom and Oscar Werner, you'll know what a false defector is because that's what Richard Burton plays in that classic film. All right, Lemus, the character from the novel. He's meant to show disillusionment with, in that novel, Great Britain, and he had been something of a spy before, and so therefore the Soviets decide, well, maybe this guy can be a target for us, but he's not really, okay? And so that's what this program was all about. Now, as Philip Melanchthon in his very good book, Spy Saga, which I think was written around 1989, 1990, He was one of the first people to pick this up with numbers. Because if you take a look at the number of so-called defectors from the United States to the Soviet Union prior to 1958, it's minuscule. You know, you might be able to come up with from, say, like 1951 to 1957, you might find three. Okay? Well, what happens is very odd here at around the time Oswald defects, which is 1959. He goes, there were four in just 1958. Four. In other words, more than all 6 years before. Okay? Then in 1959, I believe there were six. And then in 1960, you get ballooned into the teens. Okay? Now, this was so obvious that even American intelligence, a guy named Otto Otepka, who we'll talk about later, working in the State Department, said, I don't think this is a coincidence. You know? Okay? I think this is a plan.
Yeah. By the way, let me just underscore for the listeners. I'm glad you brought up Otto Otepka, because his understanding of this and the treatment he was accorded is very important. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah. And so he actually wrote a telegram to the CIA, and he drew up a list of all these guys, and he says, can you please tell me which one of these guys are genuine and which one are phony defectors? That's how obvious it was. So just based upon that, and if you consider Oswald's background, which we'll get into, all right, then you would have to suspect, you know, that, I mean, at least suspect, that Oswald was a part of Angleton's false defector program, all right? And also, which I'm sure you're familiar with, around the same time Oswald defected, a guy named Robert Webster defected. And he had been with the Rand Corporation, which had very strong ties to the CIA, all right? And if you can believe it, and I had a hard time believing this when I first discovered it, Marina Oswald meets both of these guys, one in Leningrad and one in Minsk. Okay?
She was quite the social butterfly. We'll get into Marina and her background, which is more than a little interesting as well. Again, Jim, anything else you want to add about the false defector program? And then I'd like to get to some of the deep politics surrounding Lee Harvey Oswald, the Marxist Marine.
Well, I think it's important to note that this was clearly an attempt by the CIA to increase its intelligence inside the Soviet Union. All right, and therefore it's an indication that Angleton didn't feel that he was getting enough information on the Soviets at this time, all right? So therefore, he resorted to this, you know, rather, and by the way, I mentioned Otepka. Don't you think the Russians were pretty pretty aware of what was going on also? They were, okay? They were on the guard about this, all right?
The Lee Harvey Oswald, you know, one of the things, Jim, and I think it actually the minting of the phrase or the aphorism conspiracy theory, which gets bandied about, and any time the media doesn't want to deal with something, go, oh, you know, that's conspiracy theory, as though someone were holding a fresh wet turd under their nose. And I think actually that the genesis of that actually is with a CIA memorandum on how the agency and its journalistic assets could combat critics of the Warren Commission. I think for purposes of understanding, I think a much more useful term is networking. And as one takes a look at Lee Harvey Oswald, and you detail his schooling and his early history, he actually hooked up with David Ferry as a teenager. Tell us about the Civil Air Patrol.
All right. This, I believe, is a very, very important discovery by Jim Garrison. All right. Namely, that around 1955, Oswald went ahead and joined what's called the Civil Air Patrol in New Orleans with David Ferry. Okay? Now, the Civil Air Patrol was sort of like a paramilitary Boy Scouts kind of outfit, all right, in which, you know, you would handle guns, you would go on overnight cookouts, okay? You would go through maneuvers, et cetera, all right? And Ferry had a very strong influence on, and some would say a rather, you know, imperious influence on his cadets, all right? He would take them, for example, to Keesler Air Force Base across the border in Mississippi, all right? And you had to have a military clearance to do something like that, all right? You just couldn't, you know, kids say, hey, we're going to go camping to Keesler. No, no, to get on the base, you would have to have a military clearance. There were times when some of these cadets later told Garrison and the House Select Committee that for a meeting or a seminar in Dallas, they would get on a big plane, a military plane, and then be transported. They didn't drive, okay? They actually got on a plane. So obviously, David Ferry was not your usual CAP leader. He had a very strong connections into the Pentagon and the Central Intelligence Agency. All right. Now, when Oswald joins up with the Ferry's CAP, most people who knew him at that time say that something happened to Oswald around this time, because it's around this time that he began to exhibit an inordinate interest in the whole Marxist philosophy. You know, he went out and got copies of Das Kapital, all right, and he began to, like, talk about developments in the Soviet Union. But at the same time, he's in the Civil Air Patrol, and he's talking about joining the service. Now, if anything should have raised the antenna of the Warren Commission, it's this issue, all right? How on earth would a guy in the Civil Air Patrol who wants to join the Marines somehow be reading Karl Marx and talking about friends about Russian culture? How could something like that occur? I mean, it seems to me that either somebody has a split personality or somebody is perhaps rehearsing, you know, under the tutelage of his instructor for a future intelligence operation, all right? See, the Warren Commission, and I have to say, I didn't think the House Select Committee did a good job on this either. You know, they never confronted this issue head on. And almost every author on the other side, like Vincent Bugliosi, tries to explain it away, okay? Because it's simply too much of a paradox to explain in normal terms, all right? So what happens now is that Oswald now begins to actually write Communist Party in New York City and ask to join up with their youth league organization, all right? He tries to sell some of his high school mates on the philosophy of socialism. All right, a so-called recruiter comes over to his house one day, all right, and this is going to be the pretext for him joining the military, except he's underage and he gets busted. All right. And some people actually believe that that was probably Ferry in disguise. So this is very much the beginning of what is going to be an almost bizarre journey to the other side by Lee Harvey Oswald, which nobody was prepared for prior to 1955. There just wasn't any evidence of this, okay, you know, prior to him going into the Civil Air Patrol. That's how strong of an influence that Ferry had on Lee Harvey Oswald's life.
Younger listeners, Jim, should probably be informed that even today, having a Marxist in any branch of the military, the Marines in particular, just that dog won't hunt. In 1950s Eisenhower, Cold War America, it is unthinkable. It would be a hell of a reach even to have a Marxist in the Deep South, in Texas, I mean, this, or New Orleans. I mean, this just doesn't happen. And again, Robert Galindo, other people in high school, before he goes into the Marines, are noting his Marxist, quote, sympathies, unquote. And yet, as you have highlighted for us, he is present in David Ferry's Civil Air Patrol unit. And Ferry is active on behalf of the Pentagon, the CIA, and militantly anti-communist.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Eventually, right. Oswald does join the Marines. Pick our narrative from that point, Jim.
All right. Oswald, if you take a look at Oswald's military career, there's essentially three places that he is stationed at. Okay, in the Southeast United States, in California, south of Los Angeles, the Santa Ana, El Toro area, and then in the Far East. All right. Now, one of the oddest things about Oswald being in the service is that now he not only begins to further his studies of Russian culture, he also now begins to actually study the Russian language. Okay? Now, Dave, I don't have to tell you, you know, that is really kind of odd that somebody is listening to records in the Russian language, subscribing to Pravda, okay, and reading the Russian newspaper, and somehow nobody says, is there a communist in our midst? Nobody says anything like that, all right? And so Oswald then, and this, by the way, is as Jim Garrison so memorably put it in his book on the Trail of the Assassins, when he just happened to be reading the Warren Commission volumes one evening, you know, he said he almost fell out of his chair when he discovered that Oswald was getting a Russian test, all right? And he said the reason that struck him as so odd is that he had been in the military and he had been in the reserves for a long period of time, and nobody ever asked him to take a Russian test or study, and nobody he knew had ever been asked to do such a thing. But somehow, they were giving him a Russian test. Now, of course, when the Warren Commission uncovers this, the guy makes the excuse that, he didn't do very well, okay? He got more wrong answers than right answers, all right? And, of course, Garrison goes, well, the question is that I would have got them all wrong. So, obviously, if he's studying the Russian language and taking a test. But then, of course, the end game is that before he left the service, okay, he had greatly improved. And there's an FBI interview with a woman named Rosalind Quinn, all right, who was actually formally studying the Russian language at a Berlitz school for over a year, all right? And so I think it was her brother or her cousin was a mutual friend of both, all right? And so he got them together one evening to go ahead and test their command. And Rosalind Quinn said, he spoke better Russian than I did. You know, he was pretty much fluent in the Russian language, and she was studying at Berlitz to take a job in the State Department. Now, the problem with this, Dave, is I'm sure you're familiar with, Russian is one of the most difficult languages there is to learn unless, like at Berlitz, you have an instructor or a tutor. Okay, it's not like one of these Romance languages, you know, like Italian or Spanish, which is relatively easy to learn. Okay, it's very, very, in fact, Melanson talked to a language expert and said, you know, Russian takes literally 1,000 hours, okay, of study, private intense study to pick up, all right? So the question then became, are we really to believe that Oswald, through subscribing to Pravda and listening to Russian records, became fluent in the Russian language before he left for the Soviet Union? And that seems to be undermined by the report that the Warren Commission got that Oswald had been at the Monterey School of Languages up the coast. I'm sure you're familiar where it's at, the Monterey, Santa Cruz area.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah, and he had been there studying a language. All right, this is in the Warren Commission executive sessions. All right, and I discovered completely by accident when I interviewed a guy named Dan Campbell in New Orleans and then again in Los Angeles. Dan was an expert marksman, and he was so good that the military would send him out for exhibitions, okay, and also teaching people how to shoot. He said he was in Santa Ana to do one of these exhibitions, and it went over very well, and, you know, he stayed over, and the guys wanted some more private instruction, etc. And so it got too late to pick up his plane. So he went to the CO, and he said, I'm going to have to stay over tonight, okay, because I'll pick up a plane tomorrow to get out of here, all right? And he said, so where do you want me to sleep? And he said, okay, I'll take you over to this guy. This guy's never here, this Oswald guy. He said, okay, and he said, you can sleep in his bunk. Now, the reason, by the way, that Dan remembered the name is because he was in an orphanage with Oswald very early in life and knew him from then. Okay? All right? So that's kind of a hint. And, of course, we know from Ernest Titovits, who became Oswald's best friend in Russia, in Minsk, that by the time Oswald got to Russia, he was fluent in the language. All right. So those are very, very strong indications that Oswald was getting some special instruction, okay, on how to speak the Russian language. Okay. And so this, of course, becomes very interesting later on when we'll talk about the defection. All right. Now, another part of Oswald's military career is the fact that he was educated to become a radar operator, all right? And he eventually, and this is another real, when you line this stuff up and you try and explain it away, it gets almost funny, you know? And he ends up at a Sugi Air Base in Japan. Now, as more than one person has said, including Fletcher Prouty, you know, all you got to know about is at Sugi is that that's where the U-2 flew out of. So you know it's a CIA-associated base. You know, and in fact, John Newman later found out that one of Oswald's jobs was to go ahead and guard the U-2 out of its special hangar. All right? And further, that Oswald knew, and this was very secret, that the U-2 didn't just fly over Russia. It flew over China. So that's how familiar he was, okay, with, you know, the operations going on at Atsugi Air Base, all right? Now, another interesting thing that happens with Oswald in the Far East is that he meets a guy named Richard Case Nagel.
By the way, Jim, this Richard Case Nagel is the central figure in a very long and, I believe, very good book called The Man Who Knew Too Much by Dick Russell that we have used in the past. Go ahead.
Yeah. Now, you're familiar with that book, right?
Yes, I am. I haven't read it in a long time, and it is a dense and long volume, so I'm sure there are aspects of it.
The point I'm going to say is we could talk about that just all night.
Yeah.
Case Nagel.
Absolutely.
It's such an interesting, fascinating character that you could spend 2 hours on this guy.
You know, we might want to just digress briefly. Maybe you can give us a thumbnail synopsis of Nagel and his actions immediately prior to the assassination. Again, the official version is you've got one little nut, Lee Harvey Oswald, and we are in the process of delineating and analyzing the fundamental contradictions between Oswald, the Marxist proselytizer, Oswald, the communist sympathizer, Oswald, the Russian language devotee, and the guy who is also getting security clearances and acquiring all sorts of highly specialized and classified information about sensitive military and sensitive military CIA-connected projects. But Richard Case Nagel was not your normal average bank robber, I think we could say. We're supposed to have...
That's an understatement.
We're supposed to have two lone nuts. We have the lone nut Oswald and lone nut Ruby who killed him, and that was it. And, you know, Oswald couldn't get enough sex, and Ruby didn't want Jackie Kennedy to have to go back to Dallas to withstand the rigors of a trial. And yet, if you just examine Richard Case Nagel, perhaps the strangest, quote, bank robber, unquote, in history, that blows it out of the water.
See, Nagel was on a mission to turn a certain guy named Eroshkin, who was working in the Japanese embassy in Tokyo, when he met Oswald one night, okay? And the fact that he had this association with Oswald, all right, this came in quite handy when he returned stateside, all right, and in the early summer of 1963, or maybe a little earlier than that, okay, maybe the spring, he is called into the Russian embassy in Mexico City, all right, and the Russians tell him that we understand that there is a plot to kill President Kennedy. All right. We believe that what is going to happen in reality is that this so-called plot to kill Kennedy is going to be a pretext that they can blame us on. All right. And use this to start a war with either us or Cuba. All right. So we want you to go ahead and snuff out the plot. All right, and find out whoever's being set up, either talk him out of it or kill him. All right, and so Nagel took the assignment, and he starts, by the way, I got to tell you what a good investigator, because they gave him very little to work with, all right? And, you know, and so he was essentially beginning from pretty much, you know, square A. And so he began traveling to Washington, to Los Angeles, into the Southeast, all right? And he finally finds what he believes is to be the plot to kill JFK. And, of course, it's the same plot that Jim Garrison uncovered in New Orleans. And his old friend, Lee Harvey Oswald, is the guy he understands who's now going to be set up, you know, to take the rap, right? And so thinking back to what his mission orders were, he tries to talk Oswald out of going along with these people, you know, these Cubans and these right-wing CIA agents in New Orleans. You know, he tries to explain the whole thing to him, all right? And he actually secretly tapes a couple of these guys, I think Sergio Arcacha Smith and Carlos Quiroga, talking to Oswald, all right? And when he can't talk him out of it, he can't bring himself to kill Oswald, all right? And so he decides to go into a bank in El Paso, and he made a mistake here. He misjudged when the plot was going to be, all right? And he shoots up this bank, you know, a couple of shots into the ceiling. And he quietly waits outside the bank to get arrested. All right? And he says to the arresting officer, "I'd rather be in jail in El Paso than get implicated in a plot to kill the president." All right? And that is that is the beginning of an amazing story that, as you mentioned, Dick Russell, and by the way, he shortened the book, by the way. The second version of the book is only about 475 pages. It's much more readable, all right? And I should give you, maybe I should give you this inside angle. Rob Reiner is doing a miniseries based upon that book, The Last Investigation by Gayton Fonzi, and Jim Douglas's book.
By the way,
JFK and the Unspeakable.
JFK and the Unspeakable is an excellent book, and one there are others that will too, but one that I think you mentioned near the end of Destiny Betrayed, that you spoke very highly or wrote very highly of JFK and the Unspeakable. We have dealt with that at some length on this program, and I think it complements Destiny Betrayed very well, particularly with regard to some of the Cold War maneuvering. So again, you've got Richard K. Snagel shooting up a bank in order to get arrested and warning about a plot to kill President Kennedy, which in and of itself completely demolishes the official version. Jim, thank you, by the way, for letting us in on that and for delineating Richard K., or at least part of Richard K. Snagel's story. But the going back to Lee Harvey Oswald, again, expressing Marxist sympathies, yet joining the Marines, subscribing to Pravda, learning Russian, and yet he gets a security clearance. He is associated with the U-2, with the physical security of the very secretive U-2 spy plane, and is also privy to information about radio codes, high-altitude radar, because the U-2 could one of the things that made it so revolutionary in its day was that it could fly at a very, very high altitude, one that Russian or Soviet interceptors and surface-to-air missiles could not reach at the time. So again, we have this fundamental discontinuity between our Marxist Marine and yet what he is doing. And this is to be understood not only against the background of other things that Jim is going to be setting out for us, but against the background of the false defector program that James Jesus Angleton was running for CIA.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Back to Oswald and U-2. you know, there are some remarkable coincidences, perhaps that belongs in quotes. E. Howard Hunt turns up in Japan in connection with the U2 at the same time.
Right. He had just left, okay, when Oswald got there. Isn't that amazing? And then he went ahead, and there were two other bases that they flew the U2 out of. Those are both in the Middle East, okay? And that's where Hunt was going to as Oswald got there. I think that's a very interesting piece of information, all right, that not too many people knew about, all right? So you have all of these strange, I think some people would say they were just bizarre, you know, paradoxes about this guy, okay, in his service duty. And then, of course, there's a couple of things that we should mention before we leave that segment of his life, is that, for instance, Jim Batello, in an interview he did later, said, quote, Oswald was not a communist or a Marxist. If he was, I would have taken violent action against him, and so would many of the Marines in the unit, unquote. Batello actually took him home to meet his parents. All right. David Bucknell, who also knew Oswald in 1959, all right, said that he had visited the Criminal Investigation Division, CID, at El Toro with Oswald. And at that CID meeting, they were pitched on becoming part of an intelligence operation against communists. Bucknell didn't go back, but Oswald did. All right. And he told Bucknell that the civilian recruiter at those later times would end up being was his same guy who was his contact at Atsugi. All right, he then told Bucknell that after he was discharged, he would go to Russia as part of an intelligence mission. So, I mean, you know, how much more clear do you have to get? You know? And so this is clearly, I believe, what Oswald was being groomed for, you know, by doing these things like, you know, learning Russian, subscribing to Pravda, being familiar with the U2, which, as we're going to see, figures very significantly in his defection to the Soviet Union. Now, here's the question. If these guys in the Marine unit all knew about it, and they all said that after the assassination, the CIA did a very much, you know, cursory investigation, and none of the radio frequencies were even changed, you know, when he defected the Soviet Union, all right? Well, what happened is that there was one guy who ended up being the Warren Commission's prime witness against Oswald, and that's a guy named Kerry Thornley, who Oswald met in California, and who actually wrote two books about Oswald. One was a novel, one was a nonfiction book. The novel was written before the Kennedy assassination, and the nonfiction book was written in 1965. And he's the guy who is the person that the Warren Commission report is going to rely on to picture Oswald as an unstable Marxist in the military, a guy who had social and psychological problems and wanted to end up being a big man, et cetera, and all that stuff. Now, as we're going to see later on, of course, Kerry Thornley runs into Oswald again in New Orleans, okay? And Thornley ends up being an important figure in the whole Oswald and the Warren Commission verdict later on, because it's very obvious to Jim Garrison that Kerry Thornley was lying. Now, to close out Oswald's service, there's two things that we should mention. Number one is, when Oswald filled out a passport when he was leaving the Marine Corps, one of the places he put on there was Albert Schweitzer College. All right? Now, to show you how obscure Albert Schweitzer College was in the late 50s and early 60s, when the FBI went looking for Oswald at the request of Marguerite, Oswald, his mother, who had tried to send him money and couldn't get in contact with him, they went ahead and assigned officers in France the job of finding Albert Schweitzer College. Well, guess what? They couldn't find the college. So they then got in contact with the Swiss police, all right, which, of course, is where Albert Schweitzer was. It was in Switzerland. But even when they did that, even when they handed it over to the Swiss police, all right, it took the Swiss police 2 months to find this place. Now, Dave, I don't have to tell you, Switzerland's not a big country. Okay.
Not only is it not a big country, but because of its role as a financial nerve center, things are found pretty easily in Switzerland.
Right.
There is a lot. There are many ears to the ground, so to speak,
yes,
in that country. And not only that, but Albert Schweitzer College wasn't just obscure, but like so many of the other things in this narrative, it had intelligence connections.
Right, and they were quite obvious. One of the guys backing it was Percival Brundage. You know, Percival Brundage was a very influential CIA, let's call him an asset, all right? In fact, he's one listed on the Friends of the ASC, right? And he was part of something called Civil Air Transport, okay, which we know today was a CIA proprietary, all right, that sort of like their own private air force, you know, which became quite famous, all right, later on during the Iran-Contra scandal, all right. So it's very, very odd that Oswald would, A, be able to find out about this obscure college, which only had like 30 students, you know, and B, that it was so obviously, clearly connected to the intelligence community, right? Now, another thing we should talk about before Oswald's defection is that even though Oswald only had about 3 months to serve in his enlistment, he decided to maneuver to get out of the Marines early. All right. Now, even on the surface, that's kind of strange. You know, why would you want to get out just 3 months earlier? Just wait the 3 months. And so what happened was that Oswald applied in California at the Red Cross for something called a hardship discharge. What that means is that somebody in your family needs you to care for them, and so you want to get out so you can help them. Well, it turned out that it was his mother, okay? And her excuse was that while working in a mall at a candy store, a box of candy fell on her and lacerated her nose or sinuses. And I'm not kidding you. That's supposed to be the excuse. Well, she had a hard time finding a doctor go along with this. But eventually she did. All right. And this was the excuse used by Oswald to leave the service. Now, the House Select Committee studied these hardship discharges. And they came to the conclusion that usually there was a thorough investigation that took from 3 to 6 months. Well, Oswald got his discharge in 10 days. How can you do an investigation in 10 days? You know? It's like this.
It's like so many things in this account. It does not make sense on its surface any more than Oswald, the Marxist Russian-speaking, left-traveling Marine, which is bizarre in and of itself. But who gets a security clearance? Who's physically guarding the U-2? Who's privy to all sorts of very sensitive radar and radio information? None of that makes any sense at all, but all of those obvious discontinuities make perfect sense if one looks at the whole commie, Russian-speaking, you know, left-leaning, etc., as a cover for intelligence work.
Right. That's the only way that this equation makes any practicality in reality sense, all right? So they grant him the discharge, and he does go back to Fort Worth, but he only stayed there for 3 days.
Okay. Jim, before we cover his we get into Lee Harvey Oswald's travel itinerary, before we leave his Marine Corps career, there is a very important point that I think we should underscore. The Marines place a priority on marksmanship. The Marines actually, in their initial manifestation, were stationed in the rigging of old sailing ships, and their job on a lurching, a rocking, rolling, lurching sailing ship was to pick off enemy sailors on the deck and in the riggings of enemy ships. So they placed a priority. The Marines do place a priority on marksmanship, but once again, Lee Harvey Oswald was a lousy shot by Marine standards. You go into that and use a term. The second word is bird. I can't use that on the air. But later, when Lee Harvey Oswald is alleged to have performed, aside from the physical impossibilities of the single bullet theory, where for some reason the law of inertia was suspended for a couple of seconds in Dallas, Texas, but if one looks at what Oswald is alleged to have done, the FBI's top marksmen were not able to duplicate what Oswald did, and it was made up by the Warren Commission that he was a wonderful shot. And yet, as you point out, that was not the case.
No, he took two tests, and there's three classifications, all right? And in the first test, he was at the bottom range of the middle classification, all right? The middle. The three classifications are expert, sharpshooter, and marksman, and that's the order that they're in. In his final test, which was in 1959, he scored 1 point above the minimum in the lowest classification. In other words, he almost slid off the whole scale, you know, which was marksman. All right. Now, the Warren Commission realized it had a problem here, and so they called in the Marine Major Eugene Anderson to try and explain why Oswald did so poorly as he was leaving. And Anderson said that, well, it might have been a bad day for firing a rifle. You know, windy, rainy, dark. Well, all you had to do was look up the Southern California weather for that day, and you'll find that it was sunny and bright with no rain, like it is most of the time. All right, and the temperature was between 72 and 79 degrees. Now, when Henry Hurt went and interviewed some of the guys who were with Oswald, they all said, like, for example, Sherman Cooley, I saw that man shoot. There's no way he could have ever learned to shoot well enough to do what they accused him of doing in Dallas, okay? And another guy, James Pearson, said Oswald just didn't have the physical coordination that would make him into a very good marksman, all right? And in fact, some of the guys called him what the term was a SHT bird, okay? All right.
Yep.
This meant that he was so bad the first time around, they would have to have him repeat the test. Okay? And I think everybody listening to your show remembers Nelson Delgado, where Delgado, who was also with him in the Marines, said that every once in a while, Oswald will miss the whole target. All right? So remember, what's important to remember here is that in 1959, as he was leaving, he did very poorly on his marksmanship test. And as everybody understands who plays around with rifles or handguns, you have to practice to stay in tune, all right? Well, there's almost no record, credible record, of Oswald practicing from once he left the Marines with a rifle until 1963. So if he was pretty bad in 1959, doesn't it make sense that he'd be worse in 1963? I would think so.
Absolutely. And noting also, in addition to the unthinkable contradictions in his marksmanship capability, remember that even in the Marines, some of his fellow Marines, David Bucknell and others, were told by Oswald that he was going to be involved in an intelligence mission and return from the Soviet Union a hero. And Oswald's, quote, defection, unquote, was the talk of his Marine base, and yet none of the radio codes to which he was privy were changed. Younger listeners who don't have a memory of the Cold War might, you know, scratch their heads and say, well, so what? That in and of itself is unthinkable. That would have been done. It's just that these things were not viewed in a blasé fashion then, or even really now. But it's just one more fundamental discontinuity and something that makes no sense unless we begin looking at Oswald as a spook and at the superficial manifestations of what he was doing as a cover. So Oswald, even his hardship discharge is unusual. We might also mention that he seemed to have more money than would be explained by his pay. And he decides to go to Russia, and his point of embarkation and the institution through which he arranged that is of significance for our later story. Where did Lee Harvey Oswald get his steamship ticket?
The International Trade Mart in New Orleans. It was the same office that Clay Shaw used to do his travel.
And Clay Shaw, of course, was the major focal point, the primary defendant in Jim Garrison's investigation. After David Ferry, quote, either committed suicide or had a brain aneurysm or whatever, the circumstances surrounding his death are suspicious. But again, Lee Harvey Oswald, rather, is booking his passage to Soviet Union through the very institution headed up by Clay Shaw. And we'll get into his background in future.
Oh, we should add one other thing.
Sure.
On his passenger questionnaire, he said he was in the import-export business, which, of course, is what Clay Shaw did.
Right, and the major cover, people familiar with the James Bond novels, that was the cover for James Bond's intelligence office, you know, import-export, I guess, literally true up to a point, but it depends on what one is importing and what one is exporting. And
right.
So Oswald heads to the very obscure Albert Schweitzer College in Switzerland, an institution that not even the Swiss police could locate right off the bat, something with intelligence connections. And then he goes to the city of Helsinki, Finland, and circumstances.
He goes to England, then Helsinki.
Oh, England, that's right, Southampton, I think, and then Helsinki. His presence in Helsinki is, worth discussing, both the venues at which he stayed and some very interesting characteristics of Helsinki that you lay out in your book.
Well, this is really fascinating. According to Philip Melanson, Oswald had saved up, unless he had a mysterious benefactor, he had saved up about $200 and some, which was almost the price of the transportation to get him to the Soviet Union. But then when he arrives in Helsinki, Finland, he stays at a place called the Hotel Torni. Now, I know somebody who went to that hotel. And he said, Jim, the Hotel Torni is like the Four Seasons in San Francisco. It's like the Savoy in London. It's a five-star hotel. It's one of the top hotels in Helsinki.
Still, by the way,
this is something that the Warren Commission doesn't go into at all. All right. So then, after about a day and a half at the Hotel Torni, he switches out and goes to something called the Claus Kursky. And this friend of mine went to that one too. And he said, Jim, that hotel is maybe half a star below the Hotel Torni. Okay? Some of the people who stayed at the Hotel Torni were President Herbert Hoover, Soviet Premier Alexei Kosygin, the great Finnish composer Jean Sibelius, and the Count Folke Bernadotte. So here you have this nobody, okay, staying at this guy. You know, Oswald should have been at a Motel 6, all right? And here he is at one of the classiest hotels. Now, the other thing that is so fascinating about Oswald going to Helsinki is that the Helsinki Soviet station, okay, is the embassy there, is the only one in all of Europe that grants, at that time, a visa into the Soviet Union in a matter of days, okay, at the most a week. So here we have two very bizarre questions. Why on earth would Oswald stay at the equivalent of the Hotel Savoy, and how the hell did he know that that was the one Soviet embassy in all of Europe that you could get a visa in a very, very short period of time? See, these are things that, you know, cry out for explication, you know, but we really don't have any.
Well, I think, Jim, actually, I would disagree ever so slightly. I think if we take this in concert with the other information that you have very carefully and laboriously laid out, I think it does begin to make a great deal of sense. However, I'd like to talk about that, restate that, and proceed with the travels of our Marxist Marine in our next show, because we have just a couple of minutes left here. I hope that listeners have had their interest whetted, and we're just as exhaustive a treatment as this may appear to be. We are moving very quickly. I wouldn't say glossing over things, but the book goes into much greater depth and detail than we have been able to do justice to here. If you would tell people, Jim, and by the way, we are in, as I speak, on November 27th, 2018, holiday gift Giving Season, Destiny Betrayed, and your other book would make an excellent gift. Tell them about where they can get the books. Tell them about your website and about Black Op Radio.
All right. If you go to the website that I edit and publish, it's called KennedysandKing.com, and you can get click-throughs to my two most recent books, which is this one, Destiny Betrayed, second edition, and my newer book, The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today. And Dave is very correct. For anybody who's interested in this subject, those would be two great Christmas gifts. And you'll find a lot of information at that website, stories, book reviews, news items, etc. And I'm also a semi-regular on Leno Sanek's radio show out of Vancouver called Black Op Radio.
All right, Black Op Radio, Kennedys and King. And for the thinking persons on people's holiday gift lists, Destiny Betrayed and JFK, The Evidence Today. And we will continue with the travelogue of our Marxist Marine Lee Harvey Oswald in our next discussion. This concludes For the Record program number 1035, interview number 5 with Jim DiEugenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on November 27th of 2018. For Jim DiEugenio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.